Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight is one of the smartest men I've ever met and has the greatest resume I've ever seen. He produced the Jackie Robinson radio show, was the president of Bendix, was a professor at Harvard Business School, and was managing partner worldwide of McKinsey & Company. He was also White House staff director of the Carter administration. He believes that one of the most important things in life is finishing well, and that life is a series of chapters. His name, Alonzo McDonald. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us, on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Rasula on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's Jack.
We're with Alonzo McDonald, as bright a man as I've ever met, and the greatest resume I've ever seen. Al, welcome. It's an honor.
Well, thank you, Jack. It's a great pleasure to be with you. I'm a fan of yours. I think you've done a wonderful job since you began this program on Anything Is Possible, because what you've done is given an uplift to what needs to be understood in this culture. We need to always be looking forward with some degree of hope and understanding. And I'm always impressed by what happens in this society, by people who begin with modest beginnings, but end up really is among our leaders. That's a great thing, and it differentiates our country from any other.
Speaking of modest beginnings, you were born in 28, grew up in the Depression in Georgia. Talk about that, and was that a help in your life or a hindrance?
Well, in looking at it at that point in time, I did not consider it to be a help because times were tough. I can remember when my father came home one time and said, well, I beat him today. And my mother said, why? He said, they could not get me to quit. My salary was cut in half. But he said, I wouldn't quit. But a lot of people did. And he says, within 2 weeks, they'll be trying to borrow $5. Now, at that point in time, even as a boy, I understood that we had to live within our means. And if there's anything I learned during that period, it was you do not live over your head very long without getting in deep trouble. Two kinds of trouble, financial trouble, but also psychological problem. It is very depressing. And unfortunately, our culture has evolved a little bit in that direction.
You get to New York, and you're working on the Howdy Doody show, and then you meet a man named Jackie Robinson, and you produce the Jackie Robinson radio show.
Yeah, that was back in 1952, a long time ago, Jack. But I was extraordinarily fortunate as a young man just to meet Jackie, because he's such an immortal figure in the whole sports world, as you as a sports fan know more than most. But to have an opportunity to work closely with him, to know him on an individual basis, to dine with him and his wife, Rachel, after evening ball games, to ghostwrite his 52 World Series columns that we syndicated in 124 newspapers. For a young man who was in television at that point in time, it was a magnificent opportunity. And I'm thrilled when I look back at it. I really didn't probably fully appreciate it at the time, because I knew he was an unusual figure. He was the first of a minority African-American to be a part of Major League Baseball. But when I look back at it now, 50 years later, it truly was a memorable experience, and I am most fortunate, through no real fault of my own, to be called out by my boss at that point in time. Say, I want you to meet a guy that I think you two will like each other, and I think you'll get along well.
What was the biggest thing you learned from Jackie Robinson?
I learned that life is not always fair. I can remember being with him at ball games and at dinner parties and this sort of thing, when a lot of people were still carrying through great prejudices that had been accumulated for literally a couple of hundred years in the startup and continuation of our country. And so the fact that he was breaking through barriers was amazing. So it took enormous discipline on his part to contain his temper, if you would, to contain his strength, because he was a fighter. And if he had not been aggressive, if he had not been really a winner by nature, as well as by talent, he couldn't have done it. But he also couldn't have done it without his good wife, Rachel.
We're talking to Alonzo McDonald, who had a 17 career at a company called McKinsey & Company, which is the creme de la creme of consultancy. And for 3 years, Al, you were managing partner worldwide. You ran McKinsey. What did that teach you?
Well, you don't really run McKinsey. It's again, you use the old expression that is mundane. It really is herding cats, because we had a lot of partners scattered all around the world. You know, we had offices in perhaps 25 countries at that point in time. We had any number of nationalities. We had a background of cultures. The main thing that pulled us together was a series of values. And that's the thing that has distinguished McKinsey all along. We had these basic values that everybody can understand. First of all, our clients came first. We were not working for ourselves. We were working for somebody else in their best interest. Second came the firm. We wanted to make sure that this firm was top. Third came ourselves. Anytime we thought of ourselves before the firm or before the client, that was a termination offense in McKinsey, and still is, I'm pleased to say. So it is a great firm of professionals who are dedicated to serve their clients. It was my privilege to have the difficult opportunity to take us from one generation to another. That's an extraordinarily difficult time in the life of a professional service firm that at that time had only been 40 or 50 years old. Now it's scattered around the world. I'm pleased to have contributed some of the disciplines that have been instilled within that firm, and to reorient some of its practices. I advocated a position of saying, we are available to work at points of discontinuity and not at normal things. We didn't want to be doing the things that anyone could do. But in most organizations, no one can have the type and range of talents you need to deal with all circumstances. And therefore, I said, if we work at points of discontinuity and bring in top quality people on a temporary basis, but who know those industries and who know those companies and who dedicate themselves to their well-being, role play with their key executives, then there's no way we can help but make major contributions. And consequently now, McKinsey is scattered around the world. I had the great opportunity to visit with my successor, four or five since me, because I'm the oldest living ex-head of McKinsey at this point in time. I had an opportunity to visit with him here in Detroit just about 10 days ago for a visit when he celebrated their 10th anniversary. And he's doing a great job, by the way, and so is the firm. It was also my privilege to visit their office in Shanghai, in March of this year. And again, something like five floors of consultants who are dealing with one of the major groups of that country and helping in its development. So anyway, it was my great privilege to serve them.
We're talking to Alonzo McDonald, and I'm Jack Crisul, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Brought to you by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Once again, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
Welcome back. We're with Alonzo McDonald, who from 1977 to 1980 was with the Carter administration, a number of jobs, including acting chief of staff. Al, what's the biggest thing you've learned these last 30 years from President Jimmy Carter?
Well, I guess one of the things that left an impression on me was the thoroughness with which he tried to do his job. I couldn't imagine a four more difficult year period to be president of the United States, unless that is for the one who's elected to take office in January, because I must admit I feel sorry for whoever wins that race. But nevertheless, I think that President Carter had the misfortune of having 4 years of extraordinarily difficulty in the world, in which things were not going well for anyone anywhere, and they happened to hit it at a very difficult time. He handled them with calmness, he handled them with perception, and he did his best to follow his rule of always being straightforward and honest. which did not necessarily make him the greatest politician. As I recall, he made 23 speeches saying we have to move to reduce our energy consumption. And one of the things that he got through was the introduction of a Syn Fuels bill and set up the Syn Fuels Corporation, saying we got to develop our coal sands and our car sands out in Montana and Wyoming. And later that was abandoned when prices of oil went down temporarily. Now, we've still got to do that, but unfortunately, we're 20 years later. At that time, we had an open chance. We only had about 20 to 25% of our needs in imported oil at that time. We're now up to over two-thirds. So we're in a much more difficult state, and we have to go in all different directions. But I learned from him to try to take things as they were and not necessarily personally. I learned that even though at that point in time, when I was sitting in an office adjacent to the Oval Office, I was treated by normal respect by almost everyone. It's amazing how many friends I had. I probably had thousands of Christmas cards that came in at that point in time. I couldn't have had more well-wishers. Now, the year after I left the White House, I'd say that that number dwindled enormously. But that's what happens in situations of that kind. The president also taught me a great lesson on faith, because I was a quasi-skeptic. I'd been, if you would, a closet Christian, which is not a very good one. So I went to church. I did my duty. But going through the offices of the church for me at that point in time was almost like going through a country club offices. It was just one of the things one was supposed to do. But he gave me a great sense of personal faith that carried through and has really influenced much of his work with the Carter Center afterwards.
Let's talk about this bailout loan, the $800 billion. Explain it to us, Al, and why do it?
As a matter of fact, Jack, that's the wrong term. It's not a bailout. They got, unfortunately, it was put forward by financial people instead of by marketing people. Anyone who understood it and understands it now knows it's not a bailout. It's a bailout for the American people, because the fact of the matter is, the liquidity for available loans dried up. And when we can't get loans to buy our cars, to finance our clothes, to cover our credit cards, to buy all the other things we do, including houses that we'd like to see sold and moved from time to time, our country comes to a stop. Automobile dealers have been complaining that they can't renew their inventories. They have too few vehicles. And when they do sell one, they may not be able to get proper financing for their individual customers. So this is a problem, but it's not a bailout. It should have been listed really as a rescue plan for the basic liquidity of the American economy. Wall Street has already done its breakout, if you would. You've seen the great mergers and changes that have happened there. And frankly, the government has handled it brilliantly. They're going to make money on most of these, or at least it's not going to cost much.
We've been living above our means. There's been this plague throughout America that I would call greed.
Yeah.
Politicians, speculators buying these places that we're going to flip them.
Yeah.
Golden parachutes of the fat cat, people buying a home above their means, charge balances are too high. We've been there before. How do we get through this?
Well, as a matter of fact, we are an enormously favored country. I don't know of one that is, in fact, more productive. Some of the ones in politics have said that our economy is sound. Well, it is sound, but the fact is we are in a bit of an aberration now. I've lived through six major recessions. I can remember in 1987 when the stock market went down 23% in one day only. Now, we've seen some big drops. We haven't seen anything like that. But going back to what you called by an unfortunate name and that I call, and most people who recognize it call, a rescue plan, this is not the first time. Those who argue against this on ideological grounds are just wrong. This is the sixth major time that our government has had to come to the aid of an economy, which is not unusual when the economy is comprised of literally hundreds of millions of decisions we make every day as individuals. The government can't control whether you and I decide to trade cars, whether to sell our house, whether to buy a new suit of clothes, or whether to go on vacation, or whether just in fact, to hold our money in our pocket. So we have to be careful about what we do. But this is a cultural problem, and perhaps we can think more about that.
We've lost 600,000 jobs so far this year. We've got all these jobs going overseas. We've got, 6.5% of the home mortgages are non-performing right now. Talk about those figures.
Those figures sound absolutely enormous until you put them in perspective. The fact of the matter is we have lost 600,000 jobs since January 1 because we're in what I would call a growth recession. We're bubbling along at about 0.5% to 1%, 1.5% GDP growth. That's below our expectations. Even so, if you look over the last 4 or 5 years, we're well ahead of any other developed country in the world in terms of our growth pattern. But this is a slow time because all economies that are open and free to individual choices, they all have problems in terms of going to excesses, either downward or upward. And we have been in a position of excess over the last few years, actually for the last 15 years. And now we're having to correct that. We're having to get back to the middle into some sort of equilibrium.
You told me the other day that we got 6.5% of the mortgages non-performing, but usually we have 4% non-performing.
That's exactly right. So when you look at it and they say, oh, this paper is worth nothing, that's nothing but propaganda. They don't know what they're talking about. The fact is that 93.4% of our people who have mortgages in this country are up to date and are paying them regularly. The fact is that they're bundled together at this point in time. But it makes a great headline to say we're over 50% more than last year. Yeah, but that's not that is a dramatic thing that needs to be dealt with and needs to be looked at. On an individual basis, it is tragic. From a macroeconomic basis, it's not. When you think of 600,000 jobs, we have 137 million Americans still at work. That's less than 0.5% that have lost them. We turn over more jobs every year than most economies have, as a matter of fact. And most of those jobs, in fact, are turned over due to our own increases in productivity and the utilization of our facility and the improvements in our individual workers and their output. That's what we say when we say that the basics of our economy are still strong.
Warren Buffett, brilliant man business-wise. He spent $5 billion recently with Goldman. I think he spent another $5 or $7 billion with GE the other day. What does that tell you, Al?
It tells me we're pretty close to the bottom of the market. Warren does not buy at the top and sell at the bottom. He has a long record of pretty well understanding it. But he knew exactly what he could do. And if you and I had the kind of money to do the deal he did with Goldman, we'd put in $5 billion too. If we could put in $5,000, we would on those terms. And not only that, but he's got an option to put in $5 billion more if he chooses along the line at a fixed price that is probably about even or below what the market will be at close today on Goldman Sachs. At the same time, he put in $3 billion yesterday or the day before in General Electric, just this week at any rate. And a fantastic investment at just the right time. But nevertheless, it tells me that Warren thinks that this may be a good time to make investments. Now, he did good deals, but we ought to be very careful ourselves because too many people bail out at the bottom and buy at the top.
We're talking to Alonzo McDonald, and I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Presented by Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm. Now, here's your host, Jack Crisula.
Welcome back. We're with Alonzo McDonald, the former managing partner worldwide of McKinsey & Company. Al, you've written 18 or 20 35-page readings, if you will, on many subjects. 10 years from now, if you write one on this current crisis, what will it say?
That's a very good question, Jack, because the chances are people won't even know what I'm talking about. How many people know what the Resolution Trust Company is if you went down the streets of Detroit today? That happened 10 years ago, in which the government had to move in on one of our last major emergencies of this type because we lost over half of our savings and loan institutions, which were our major mortgage outlets at the time. Actually, there's a dispute over how much that cost us, but actually a fraction of what one expected at the outset. But the government had to take over and really look after the assets of these mini savings and loan. But if you looked at it now, 10 years later, it's forgotten. 10 years from now, I think this will be forgotten too, just like the other five recessions that I've lived through. When I mention 1987, a few people say, 19 what? And I say, the one of 1973, you know, when the Dow Jones lost 50% in 18 months. You know, I was in France when the country closed down for 6 weeks, and it looked like it was the end of the day. It looked like it was the end of the era. And yet, the year after that, it was one of the greatest periods of growth. I'm always amazed at human resilience, how we bounce back, and particularly in this country, because our culture is to do things from the bottom up. We say, oh, why isn't there leadership? Why isn't there leadership? Because we don't really accept strong leadership. Our forefathers never did, and neither do we. We're going to do what we think is in our best individual best interest. We vote that way. We think that way. We take decisions that way. We spend our money that way, and we're going to continue to do that. Our leaders and our institutions run rapidly to try to keep up with us. That's the way the society works. It's the only one in the world. I've lived in five different countries, all of whom claim to be, if you would, democracies. They were self-governing countries of one kind or another. All had different forms of government, but their cultures were different from ours. They expected leadership from the top, and the people did not move until they got instructions.
Let's traverse to China.
Okay.
First time you were there was 1978 or 79, mm-hmm. Second group ever to go. Then you and Susie went in 1998. And earlier this year, you went with former President George Bush a third time. Tell us about this sleeping bear that has awakened.
Well, I was enormously blessed to go in 1979 because I'd just come back as ambassador who had completed the Tokyo round of trade negotiations with 99 countries in Geneva. And we had successfully completed that for the United States. And I was very grateful to have the opportunity to sign in April of 79 on behalf of the U.S. approving the Tokyo round. I got back to Washington and was named the acting special trade rep, which is the equivalent of our minister of trade. And I was asked to go by the president then on a mission to China as the second commercial delegation we had. Ambassador Robert Strauss and I led that delegation. And it was a fabulous time because Deng Xiaoping had just taken over 6 months earlier and began to change all the basic ideas of Mao prior to that time. And we had discussions with him on two different days and were entertained in the Great Red Palace at night in a formal dinner, etc. So it was an unusual time. But the China of that time was one of the worst developing countries that I had seen. The roads were no more than two lanes. Potholes were everywhere. We were escorted to go up to see the Great Wall of China as a tribute to us. Coming as one of the few outsiders who came to China that year, we were put in a Chinese limo to go up. Now, twice we had to stop because it was pretty hilly territory, because the engine overheated. And so we stopped in a little village each time. They drew a bucket of water from one of the peasant wells there, poured it on the engine, poured it in to fill up the tank again, and we rolled on. Now, that indicates what the country was doing. I went to Shanghai. I was in a hotel that had been painted the last time in 1934 when it was owned by the French before the communists had taken over. The bathrooms hardly worked at all. When you looked across the great river there in Shanghai, there was nothing but wetlands and swamplands. Now, when I was there in March, all you saw was rows that looked like cornstalks, a building 16 to 20 stories high. I've never seen a highway system in any major city in the world like the one in Shanghai and Beijing at this point in time. For example, I think Chicago is now considering a third round ring around the city. In Beijing and in Shanghai, they now have six round rings. In Shanghai, there are 5 million people that live within ring number one. So we cannot imagine, without really seeing it firsthand, how much has happened. So I've enjoyed seeing it at various stages, but beginning with Deng Xiaoping and his decision to shift to a market-based economy, not a central government one. And we have to be careful in our country we don't follow a pattern of going to too much central government one. Leave it to the people.
Our stock market is down 16% this year. China's is down 57%.
57%.
How have they made this unbelievable transformation, Al?
Well, actually, they've done it by in various rude ways. The Russians tried to do it in an awkward way by taking over the major enterprises. That takes a lot of capital, steel, et cetera, et cetera. No, the Chinese were very simple because most of their people were on the farm. As a matter of fact, still 60% of their people are on the farm, if you can believe it. We're down to less than 3% in our country, and we produce more than we did when I was a boy, in which we still had 25 to 30% of our people employed in agriculture. But they've done it by, in fact, opening up the bottom. First of all, they said, for farmers, you can now choose what you want to do on one quarter of your acreage. The next year, then they said, I tell you what, you can even sell that yourself. And so you begin to see bicycles with things on people's backs going in and setting up stands beside railroad stations and in small towns. They begin to say, if you employ less than 20 people, you can do whatever you like. You know, you don't have to be a federally owned barbershop. And so we begin to see near the train stations, we begin to see 20 to 25 chairs set up with barbers behind them. We begin to see noodle sellers, you know, on their knees and on the sitting on their haunches, which is an old Chinese and Asian practice, you see, producing noodles on the side and selling them as they went through. So we saw an innovative entrepreneurial spirit that came from the very bottom. It's amazingly enough, when their population now, they have to have 8 to 9% growth a year or they lose employment, which causes a major problem.
We're talking to Alonzo McDonald. When we come back, we're going to talk to him about he believes that life is a series of chapters. And in 2001, something happened to him, started a new chapter. And I'm Jack Prisula, and this is Anything Is Possible, presented by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Trust in Us, a world-class executive search firm, presents Anything Is Possible with Jack Prisula on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Alonzo McDonald, who's authored a number of readings, one of which is a 35-page reading entitled Confessions of a Wandering Soul. Al, you have quadruple bypass surgery in 2001. How did that change your life?
Well, it's nothing like being close to the end of the road to begin to focus your attention. As one of the great British philosophers said, you know, if you're going to be hanged tomorrow, you really do get serious about life today. And when you're, in fact, going under the knife to know that a certain percentage do not come out at the end of the day, why, it's a time to rethink the situation. I'm reminded of the thought of Soren Kierkegaard, the great Danish philosopher, who said, "We look forward with hope, but we look backward with understanding." And in my case, it brought on a new level of understanding. I started thinking back, how in the world, Al, did you have the opportunity to have 10 different career phases? How did you have all these situations? There was absolutely no way you could have planned it. There's no way you could have prepared for it. These were a set of circumstances in which, admittedly, you took enormous risks with each one. You left whatever you had and started something new. So there was a personal element of, if you would, a quirk of personality. But I was not the one who stimulated these opportunities. I was only the one that, after the door was slightly open, I moved in. But this made me think back on what had happened over a period of time. And I finally concluded that this was, in fact, intended to be by a power that was greater than I was. And so I wrote Confessions of a Wandering Soul saying, you know, I have to be guided by some transient power. I call it God. Other people can call it whatever they like. But there was something beyond me that steered me into these situations and that consoled me and helped me when I had failures, because we all have. I've had failures in business. I've had failures in politics. I've had failures in every area of life I've been in. But the winners are those who know how to handle the broken rungs on the ladder. They hang on and do not let themselves descend to the one below. They hang on and pull up by their arms and hands with one foot to the next one higher. And that's exactly the strength that I found, but I found it was beyond my personal willpower. It had to be something stronger. And so I became closer to thinking and worrying about my spiritual life, which I decided I was a spiritual dwarf, that I'd had many other positions of power and understanding and even economic successes. But I was not sure that my relationship with my Creator was a good one or a sound one.
In the book, Confessions of a Wandering Soul, over and over you use this phrase, God's guiding hand.
I don't know any better way to describe it, because there was some power moving me in various directions. There was some power that gave me the strength to get up when I was thrown down. There was some power that even gave me the willpower when I was in a man in my 70s and going through quadruple bypass, to go through the agony of the pain and afterwards the long recovery part, and to begin to start a physical program within about 2 weeks after the operation. I was already in rehab. I was going down and saying, how much can I do on a bicycle? How much can I move? What do I have to do with my weight? How do I have to change my way of living? How can I live fully whatever time God intends for me? In the book of Psalms, it says, even before we are born, he has determined in the book of life how many days we will be given. I wanted to make sure that I didn't cut him short. So I wanted to try to get myself in good position, and I wanted to appreciate that it was his guidance, not my own will and not my own self, that I could take credit for what I'd done.
Another one of these readings was entitled Finishing Well. Mm. What does that mean?
Well, finishing well, we all write the chapters of our lives as we go. We can either decide that we want to do the best we can, and we're continually striving for another level of accomplishment. And accomplishment to me means giving something to society, giving something to their family, giving something to their neighborhood, giving something to their country, giving something to the world we live in. And so I've tried to think of how I could write these last chapters, because when you begin to get, I'm now in my 99th decade. I mean, I'm 80 years old. Now, it's easy to spend all day in doctor's office and complaining about aches and pains, but that's not the way to finish well. So I stay active. I try to keep a small office going. I'm predominantly involved in my foundation, which is entirely aimed towards service to Jesus Christ in various ways and to encourage distinguished scholars for Christ around the world. And so what one chooses to do in their closing days with their relationships, with their families, their time with their friends. Well, I even play golf with you every now and then, and you beat the tar out of me, but you just don't give me enough points.
Nonsense. A sandwagon buzzard if I've ever seen one on the course. If you want to learn more about his readings, the Trinity Forum, www.ttf.org. What do you say, Al, to the person who says, I talk to God, but he never answers my prayers?
I'm reminded of a story from Mother Teresa. They said, Mother Teresa, what have you been doing the last hour? And she says, oh, I've been talking to God. And she said, what did you say? She said, I didn't say anything. I was listening. And she said, well, what did God say? Oh, he didn't say anything either. He was also listening. Now, that's what you really call meditative prayer. That's what is really important. The important thing is not what we say, not what we ask for, but the fact that we put ourselves in position to be in God's presence to the best that our limited human capacity will permit. And sometimes if we just take 30 minutes or an hour and sit quietly in silence and solitude, we discover a new life that we don't find in the hectic world that is controlled by our cell phone, by our faxes, by our computers, you know, by the hectic life that we now lead, which is totally abnormal for our normal human functions. So we have to figure out ways to get balance. And in my view, silence and solitude in the presence of God is the best I know. For the last 17 years now, I've taken a week's religious retreat each year, you know, even in a denomination to which I did not belong at the time, in order to have instruction, in order to think more deeply in terms of changing my mindset from what I was doing every day in the office, from what I was doing with investments, what I was doing with my foundation, in terms of saying, wait a minute, I want to know what is really important in this life, and I don't want to miss any of it, including that part that comes from the divine.
In your Confessions of a Wandering Soul, you say, we're all haunted by the one famous question, who am I? Mm-hmm. How do each of us learn who we are?
This is a question of humility, Jack. We never learn who we really are. You know, we're continually asking ourselves because we're redefining ourselves every day by every decision, by every relationship we have. And we need to be thinking consciously of that as we do. When we go back to Socrates and to Epictetus in the ancient Greek days, they said, you know, an unexamined life is not worth living. And when we think of that, each of us, it deserves to spend a considerable amount of our time rethinking our lives and thinking of who God wants us to be.
Last question. What advice would you give to each of us tonight, Al?
There are many things that one can say, but I'll just share some of the thoughts I've done with my kids. The first one is to say, keep your values high. Remain flexible in this world because you do not control it. You also don't want circumstances to control you. You want to adapt and you want to use everything you can within your willpower. But every now and then, as Clausewitz said about war, even though we got a great strategy, every now and then we have to take into account the enemy. Also, live within your means and recognize the power of compound interest. Save something. Let your money make money for you. That's the only way to really have wealth in this life.
Alonzo, I've really been blessed in my life, and one of the biggest blessings these last 10-plus years has been able to come to you with questions on politics, religion, history, business. I find you brilliant. Thanks for being a friend.
I'm honored. Thank you, Jack.
Our guest next Sunday will be another man, Dallin Peterson, who started Molly Maids, sold it, and now he and his wife take prisoners who have been recently released from prison into their home and help them get reestablished. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spahoma.